This is Read On Air with Red Zell, for those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, but it's not about me. This is your community one-stop shop for sharing your discoveries and delights from the world of reading. Across the coming weeks, we'll hear from authors and readers of all kinds of books, and where you can extend my literary horizons with favourites chosen by you. So if you like what you hear, or even if you don't, just get in touch. Email us at readonair@rnib.org.uk or tweet us at RNIB Radio using the hashtag #readonair. So, what's coming up in our show this week? As the Costa Book Award is due to be announced on the 31st of January, Sebastian Barry tells us how it feels to be up on the podium.
It is the circus stopping at your garden gate and saying, would you like to hop on? And you go up the road with the strong man and the bearded lady for a while. They will drop you off at some rainy town and say you can walk home from here. Until that point, it's great fun.
This year, the RNIB writing competition has a very distinguished judge on the panel. We hear from Joanne Harris, author of Chocolat, about her life as a writer.
These little marks that we make on the page can make such a difference to people you've never met.
And I get to meet a personal hero, Lynn Reed Banks, who told me about the books of her life. All coming up on Read On Air. One of life's great pleasures is to settle down with a warm mug of something and lose yourself in a good book. As the world rushes by, being transported to another place and time is a joy that has few equals. The Costa Book Awards recognise and reward some of the most enjoyable books of the year, written by authors based in the UK and Ireland. As the Day of Judgment approaches, let's hear from Sebastian Barry, who again is in the running for Book of the Year after winning Novel of the Year for Days Without End.
What was the inspiration for this particular novel, Days Without End? Because it doesn't seem like your typical Irishman goes to America kind of story.
No. And inspiration is a big word. I mean, I read Latin and English at Trinity College. Very slowly reading the Latin, let me tell you. I wasn't very good at it. But it was very... very exciting. And of course, the Latin writers talked a lot about inspiration. The God inspirare, breathing into you, or the muse breathing something into you. And of course, you can say that's absolute nonsense and tosh if you like, but you can't underestimate the foolishness of the writer's life, the necessary foolishness that goes towards making something. And we have to believe in pretty questionable things like inspiration. But with this book in particular, I would make some claim for it because I did sit there. Now, I wanted to write a book in answer to one tiny thing that my grandfather had told me when I was a little boy. My grandfather and I shared a room in the house. So he often told me a lot of stories. He had been in the British Merchant Navy when he was 16. Now, he's an Irishman from Sligo. He'd been a Royal Engineer in the Second World War, defusing bombs in southern England and all sorts of other work. And he told me in passing, I'm sure, that his great uncle had been at the Indian Wars. Now, for a little boy to hear that, who was probably raised on cowboy films, you know, that was a very suggestive remark. And it just, unfortunately or fortunately, took me another 50 years to get it together in my head. But even so, or what that story might be, but even so, I did spend about 9 months writing a first chapter, actually about Thomas at the famine, until I realized, which is what prompts him to go to America, but until I realized that a man like him, like many soldiers, in fact, would never have talked about that. So in the end, I got rid of that chapter because I realized he would probably say three things about that, and that was it. And that was very freeing because it then became a book about things not said, that the past would be left in the past. And it's a book about going forward. And even though it's quite violent, and because he's a soldier and he sees a lot of violence and deals with a lot and visits a lot of violence upon people, nevertheless, it is a book about the privilege of being alive and what he wants to tell us. And therefore, because he's telling it to me first, I mean, I'm just a critter sitting in an old rector's study in Wicklow, in the Wicklow Mountains. I'm just that person listening to him tell me the story. Because for me, it's not about writing. It's about hearing and seeing in the mind's eye. I mean, if it's not happening in your head, it's nothing to do with outside sight, you know, or a regular sight or whatever you'd call it. It's to do with what's happening in the imagination. It is like dreaming in a very strict and formalized way, you know, with a lot of strictures. And then it can happen rather piercingly just there, where all the light and color of the imagination is, so that especially the realm of America of the 1850s, which is full of these undiscovered, extraordinary landscapes,
many soon
to be erased, but they can exist in your mind and behind your mind's eye. And you can, once you start hearing your characters telling you the story and talking to each other, I mean, I have to say, it is a very thrilling occupation when that happens. It doesn't happen with every book. So I would make some, not a claim from my inspiration, but that the book itself was somehow ready in the air, in the ether, to be breathed through me anyway onto the old MacBook Pro, that ancient instrument of writing.
And do you feel like the sort of the storytelling of your grandfather has kind of come out in your novel at all?
My grandfather had many things he couldn't talk about. He was a wonderful grandfather. But in his earlier manifestation as a husband, I'm afraid he'd been a bit of a scoundrel. And he had certainly been a very large practicing drunkard, and had wreaked havoc on many lives. But the time I got him, he was telling stories and he was sober. But you can imagine that a person like that has to be a bit circumspect about a lot of the things he's saying. Now, my mother, by contrast, was a person who, I mean, as her psychiatrist, who was a friend of mine, said, never an unspoken thought. She simply said everything out and had no sense of discretion at all. I mean, if you wrote the most egregious, horrendous, libelous play or novel about my mother, which nobody ever did, thankfully, she would have said, I don't care, it's nothing to me. Or she believed in saying things and she told us stories obsessively. And I think that engine of storytelling that was in her, sometimes channeled into, say, even Beatrix Potter, you know, Mrs. Tiggywinkle.
Yeah.
And she was a brilliant actress. She was an actress at the Abbey Theatre. So she was an absolutely wonderful reader. Mm. I mean, would have been, I don't know if she ever did any audiobooks. I'm not even sure they really existed. She only died in 2007, but I don't think she ever did an audiobook, but she would have been absolutely magic doing them.
Yeah.
So I think that's where I got kind of that force, that belief that words don't have to be weighed down by themselves. They can actually be part of a free atmosphere, you know, a sort of a realm of freedom. It was what she always made me feel as a child, because she was interested in being alive. She loved being alive, and she was interested in talking about things that seemed to her adventurous. And I guess that's a novel.
Now, your book has been created as an audiobook. Did you have much influence in that?
Well, only in a rather lovely sideways, accidental way, in that, because I've worked in the theatre, I've written about 12 or 13 plays, and Aidan Kelly, I think, who does the audiobook here, was in one of my plays called The Pride of Parnell Street, in one of the editions, or whatever you would say, or a touring production, and he was lovely in that. So when I heard he was doing it, I was really pleased. Now, with this book, of course, it was a decision. Should it be done with an American accent, you know, sort of Tennessee accent, or should it be an Irish accent? That was a question that had to be answered. And Aidan answered it by doing it as an Irish person who would have retained his accent from his youth, which was a very interesting decision to me. Because you can, like, on the BBC Book at Bedtime with Stanley Townsend, who's another magnificent actor, he went for the American accent. And he's a very deep-throated, you know, very masculine voice, which was really interesting for doing Thomas.
Yeah.
But Aidan, what really thrilled me was that when Aidan went in and did his 3 days incarceration, you know, you're in
the studio,
a
closed, you never get out.
Room. Yeah, they barely feed you. If you don't, if you get a word wrong, no doubt, you feel the stripes across your back. But anyway, when he came out of that, he wrote me this beautiful letter, which I've never had a letter from an audiobook actor, genius. And it was about the experience of doing it. And apparently I had met him somewhere at a play And he asked me what I thought of this particular play. I can't remember what it was. And I said, well, it was much better than it needed to be, which is like the greatest compliment you can pay in a way.
Yeah.
Because you can be successful without it being absolutely. And he said to me, I just want to return that remark to you. This was, I kept thinking this is so much better than it needed to be. And I was a very happy, you know, person when I got a letter like that. So that was my association. Otherwise, I'm going to try and get the right person and then absolute freedom for them, because their instincts are so refined, so arcane in a way, actors' instincts. You just don't want to mess with them. Like, the job of the author in rehearsal, even if you're there for 6 weeks, is don't say anything, because anything you say will not be helpful. This is one of the realities of life.
Yeah, I know that from my experience of audiobook creation, it's a very personal experience, the relationship between the actor and the book. And therefore, you feel everything so much more keenly as you're reading it out loud. And I wonder if he really felt it when he was reading yours out loud.
He did. And it'll never be read like that again. That's what struck me.
Yeah.
So closely, so intimately, almost like writing it on the air for the first time.
Yeah.
It's a huge responsibility in a way, but the thing about actors is, if good ones know no fear. I mean, they are amazing. it mightn't be the trenches in the First World War. Let's not compare it to that, but it takes enormous courage. Because you're making a mark on the silence that has to be authentic. And I think his feeling was that he had just gone back to the 1850s, which was my feeling when I was writing it, that it wasn't about the past at all. It was about an alternative, contiguous, quite close, present in some strange way. I mean, that's why I find it exciting to think about. And, at the moment, we're feeling these amazing conversations about it as a film or as a TV series, but at the same time, the way to release it as a noise is very special to me, because, as I said to you before, I'm listening for the whistle tune of the book myself initially. Mm. It doesn't exist until I hear this signal. So I'm hearing it basically for myself. So he's replicating in a form in which it can be heard. So in a way, it's a little, that little bit closer. It's avoiding the whole technique and factuality of books, which is wonderful too. But it's going aside from that and taking a step further back to the origin of the book.
Sometimes there can be a bit of controversy about audiobooks. I mean,
really? I've never heard of it.
Well, some people kind of feel like it's not like reading. It's not like experiencing a book. As a book, you're experiencing a performance in the same way that you get TV and film adaptations. This is an adaptation. Even if it's unabridged, they feel like it's an adaptation. It's someone else's interpretation being imposed almost on you. And there was a lovely quote that someone said to me, that they thought it was the Kentucky Fried Chicken of literature, in that it's easy to consume but not very nutritious.
I would radically disagree. I mean, first of all, yeah, well, I'm sure that could be argued. But let's say, I'm very interested in voice signature, because it's a possible eternity for somebody. If you get somebody, a wonderful actor like Ian Kelly, and then you get a form in which he can always exist. That's one thing. I mean, if you were going for the primal voice, it wouldn't be my voice, it would be Thomas. The actual characters in the book, the character in the book who tells the story. So we don't have access to that. So I don't regard audiobooks, oddly enough, I'm just technically as a performance, but more as a telling.
Yeah.
Which is a hugely different thing. That's why I would be so terrible at it, because I would perform it. I mean, what people like from me in a reading, in a festival or whatever, in short bursts, is the fact that, surprisingly, poor ancient Mr. Barry decides to perform the book. He does all the voices and moves his arms around a bit. So that's lovely for 20 minutes, I suspect. It's exciting to see an author actually, functioning as a human being. I guess that's what it is. I don't know. It's like waking the dead. I have no idea why it works, but it does seem to work. I mean, anyway, the bar is really low in performance for an author. You know, I remember the wonderful Brian Guinness, Lord Moyne, reading his poetry. He just mumbled into his hand at a microphone. No one could hear a thing. But they were quite happy. They were just happy to see him there, you know, whatever it was. This is in the 70s, God bless. But, you know, so it's a low bar. But this telling, this business of telling, like I write plays that have a lot of monologues in them, like long monologues. There's more dialogue in my books. So the telling of something, for me, is deeply theatrical. But it has to be a sort of cousin of performance or a sister of performance. So the skill is immense as far as I'm concerned. So if you're talking about it as Kentucky Fried Chicken, which I have no argument with. I mean, I think, you know, it's the supreme cooking of the chicken leg, if you ask me, on its day. It's fairly nutritious, too. I don't mean to criticize your friend. But I don't know. I see it more as an act of magic. I mean, potentially, you know, my friend Colm Tabin's book, I think, was it Brooklyn or it was read by Meryl Streep. You know, there's a certain magic in that. Yeah. Like, this is somewhere you can always hear Meryl Streep tell a story rather than perform or do her dialogue or, you know, hit her spot or, you know, get the angle of the camera right. It's so intimate that you could argue for it as being a sort of supreme example. For instance, wouldn't it be wonderful, with Yeats, for instance, we only have 6 or 7 of instances of, I think, him reading his poems on the radio, on BBC.
Yeah.
So that's it. Joyce, I think, half a page of Finnegan's Wake is all that exists. Tennyson, it's an awfully muffled Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yes.
The voice, the human voice captured, seems to me so extraordinarily magical and important. I mean, I have been a lover of photography. I get so much from old photographs because essentially when everyone's dead and gone, it's ghost, isn't it? It is. It's literally the shadow, like the Victorian idea of the ghost as a photographic image on the imagination. And this whole, I mean, audiobooks are in their infancy anyway. It's like the early days of film and what we feel about early silent films. So, no, I think it's a form of magic. It's one of the branches of literary magic, the audiobook.
Thank you to Sebastian and best of luck to all the finalists. The announcement of the winner will be made on January the 31st, a nail-biting time for all concerned, I'm sure. Not all of the shortlisted titles are available in accessible form yet, but will be soon, no doubt. We'll keep you posted in the weeks ahead. Many previous Costa winners are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library, and here are some titles you might like to try. Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies, Talking Books number 19919, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon, TB number 13534, or The Lie Tree by Francis Harding, TB number 23014. Whether you've just read something fantastic and want to share it with the world, or there's an old classic that's your rainy day go-to read, tell us about it. Get in touch via email at readonair@rnib.org.uk or tweet us at RNIB Radio using the hashtag readonair.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Do you get stuck when it comes to technology? Don't worry. Help is at hand with RNIB's Technology Support Squad. We can give you advice over the phone or visit you at home to help you master your technology. Help is at hand, from setting up a mobile phone and getting the most out of it to using the accessibility features on your PC. Or maybe you need help with your Daisy talking book player. You can email technologysquad@rnib.org.uk and we'll get right back to you. Or call our helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Get the most out of your technology with RNIB's Technology Support Squad.
This is Read On Air.
Now, for most of us, books and literature have at some point changed our lives. Whether you were bowled over by something you read at school, or your world suddenly expanded when you heard your first talking book, the power of a good book cannot be overestimated. Someone whose books have had an influence on my life is author Lynn Reed Banks. From when I first hid under the covers as a 7-year-old reading the Indian in the Cupboard series to sneaking the L-shaped room from my mum's bedside table, Lynn Reed Banks has been a constant throughout my life. So it was a dream come true when I was lucky enough to spend an afternoon with Lynn and ask her about the books that have resonated through her life.
I think the book that really turned me on to being a writer at a time when I thought of myself as an actress was Agnes de Mille's Dance to the Piper, which was her autobiography. Agnes de Mille was Cecil B. DeMille's niece, which should have helped her to, you know, scale the heights without too much effort, but it didn't work out that way. She had to work very, very hard to get noticed, because her choreography and her solo dancing was so extraordinary and so out of the mainstream that nobody reckoned her. They all thought she was doing things that nobody could understand, and they wanted just ordinary classical ballet or some jazz dance, whatever they called it then. And it wasn't until she was engaged to choreograph Oklahoma back in the 40s that suddenly everybody thought, where has this amazing talent been? Why have we neglected it? And she then went on to be one of the most famous choreographers in Hollywood. But the book was, Dance to the Piper was such a beautiful book and such an evocation of thankless, unrewarded struggle and then bursting into brilliance. And I thought, you know, if she can do it as a performer, she can also be a writer and write at this level. I want to be like that.
Do you find yourself returning to old favourites?
I am reading some of my own old books, and I'm reminded of George Bernard Shaw, who asked by a reporter such as yourself, "Mr. Shaw, why are you so prolific? Why are you writing so much?" And he said, "Because I want something interesting to read in my old age." And I've got to say, I quite like reading my old books, and I'm proud of them. And now that my eyes are playing me false, I can sort of know what's coming next. So it doesn't matter if it's a bit blurry. Now, you're asking me about other books. And I do very much admire Anthony Horowitz. I think he's a genius. If I met him now, I would thank him from my heart for helping me with my widowhood, because my husband and I used to love watching Foyle's War, and I've got a lot of them backed up. And when I'm feeling, you know, a bit down and wanting very good entertainment, but also wanting to remember how we used to watch together and enjoy it, the theme music makes me cry. But the Foyle's War is absolutely brilliant and can easily stand a second or even a third viewing. And I would like to thank him for writing those really very good scripts.
And when you read for pleasure, what do you read?
Well, I think my curl-up book, if I can ever get my eyes right again, would be Smith's Gazelle by Lionel Davidson. This is a book I absolutely adored from first reading. It's a thriller with a complete difference. The crime is shooting and killing wild creatures to the point where they're about to become extinct. And there are these gazelles, which are almost the last of their kind. And a hunter pays someone to take him out to get a trophy for one of these beautiful gazelle. And it's about an old shepherd or some a very eccentric old man who manages to corral some of these creatures and breeds them and to try to keep them from extinction. Anyway, Lionel Davidson, whom I knew quite well, he's a good friend, and he wrote just the kind of novels that I love to read and would love to write.
Lynn Reed Banks, thank you so much for letting us listen to the books of your life. Thank
you. It was a pleasure to meet you, Red.
We'll hear more from Lynn in later shows, but in the meantime, I'd love to hear from you about which of her books, whether for children or adults, you have read. A quick search in the Talking Books Library will give you some of her best-loved titles to enjoy, and you can get in touch with me via email at readonair@rnib.org.uk.
This is Read On Air.
Another writing competition is also underway, and just like the Costa, its deadline is getting close. It's the RNIB's writing competition, which is in its 10th year, and to mark that, the theme this year is anniversary. So long as you get them in by the 31st of January, there is a chance that you could win. Heading the panel of judges this year is novelist Joanne Harris, and she spoke to us about the ups and downs of being an author.
Hi there, I'm Joanne Harris. I'm the author of many books, and I'm going to be judging the RNIB competition in January.
Joanne, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. There's so much we could ask you about, and I thought I'd start by asking, what's the hardest thing about being a writer?
Well, you know, it's not like being down a mine or anything, but I think part of it is the state of having to adjust between either being alone and working or being a public figure and being in the public eye. And there is really nothing in between. An author's life is really either very slow or very fast. And there's not much of a gear change between them. I've just come back from 2 weeks of traveling all over the world and being on duty all the time. And sometimes coming down from that is a bit tricky.
And what's the most, and I guess these answers might actually overlap, what's the most wonderful thing about your life as a writer?
Well, the most wonderful thing is a very similar thing. It's getting to connect with so many people all over the world through basically telling stories, which is an astonishing thing when you think about it, that these little marks that we make on the page can make such a difference to people you've never met. And they can connect you in different ways, and they can make people think or laugh or cry or do all kinds of things, react in all kinds of different ways. And it is probably one of the closest things to magic we've got.
That's a great way to put it. What would you say to someone who perhaps is thinking of entering the competition and hasn't quite managed to get around to it yet? They really want to do it, but something is holding them back.
There are too many people who are worried about the stories that they're going to write, and they have a fear of the blank page, they have a fear of being judged, they have a fear of not being good enough. None of those things matter. We all have those feelings. Trust me, on any level of writing, we all have insecurities, and it's a good idea just to ignore them, to set them to one side, and just to make whatever art you can, make it as good as you can, enjoy it, send it out there. Nothing bad can happen.
Now, you've been a judge on several prestigious writing competition panels so far. You know, it must be difficult because every person that's entering has a different writing style and is so unique. So what are you actually looking for?
I think it's difficult to say. You usually know when you've found it. Primarily, you need to be engaged. You need to feel that the person is telling you something that you want to hear in a way that you want to hear it. And so that can be anything. That can be a beautiful writing style, it can be a great story, it can be a combination of terrific characters. It should ideally be all those things. But sometimes something has a charm which is elusive, and it's very difficult to say exactly what it is that charmed you. It just did. Sometimes I think what it boils down to is the passion of the writer.
And you've said that growing up you were told not to confuse stories with reality. Do you think to be a successful writer you actually do need to let your stories bleed into your reality?
Reality is full of stories. Reality is where stories come from. I think there is no possibility of unlinking those things. The world is absolutely full of stories. The trick, if you're a storyteller, is to find them and to know how to tell them in a way that hasn't been done before.
You obviously famously are the author of Chocolat and Different Class, but you're working on something else at the moment. Tell us what you're doing just now.
Well, I've just come back from a tour of Singapore and then Italy. I'm about to launch Rune Marks, which was written over 10 years ago, and which is being relaunched in London next week by Gollancz, with a different first chapter and some changes. I'm co-writing a musical with somebody in London,
Wow.
And I'm working on a sequel to my book, Gospel of Loki, which came out earlier last year.
That sounds very exciting. Well, Joanne, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us, and best of luck with all your endeavours that you've got going on at the moment.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
As soon as the winners are announced, we'll cover it on this show. And if you find yourself suddenly inspired, please check the RNIB website for the competition details. But you better be quick. Joanne Harris's acclaimed novel, Chocolat, is available from the Talking Books Library, TB number 12558. And her most recent publication, The Gospel of Loki, is also available, TB number 21392. So, have you ever slid a disc into your Daisy machine, pressed play, and heard the narrator read a title you have no memory of requesting? I hope it's not just me. Anyway, I put it down to poor eye-hand coordination when using the library website. Or maybe there's a gremlin in the system that likes to throw random titles at me. Anyway, it's led to some interesting reads over the years, and in the case of Blue Above the Chimneys, the discovery of a hidden gem. I know, in the world of books, talking or otherwise, you should never judge a book by its blurb. But the smooth voice telling me that Christine Marion Fraser grew up in the govern of the 1940s and 50s and at the age of 10 was struck down by a rare and incurable disease, it all just sounded too much like a misery memoir. But I couldn't have been more wrong. Christine Marion Fraser's autobiography shimmers with warmth, humanity and optimism.
The morning passed slowly, but eventually we were all on the tram, excitement oozing from us with every turn of the wheels. The hot, dusty fairground was a place of magic, a wonderland of bustling happiness. My eyes tried to take it all in at once. Alec's breath came out in tight little puffs. Kirsty looked with serene yearning at the cheap jewellery displayed in colourful profusion everywhere. But none of us asked our parents for anything that wasn't offered. It was treat enough to be there, to feel part of the fun-filled world. Music blared, people screamed from huge mechanical monsters that zoomed around in dizzy whirls of motion. There was a maze of sideshows, and we were given 3 pennies each to spend as we wished.
She doesn't sugarcoat the govern tenements or the poverty. Far from it. It's sometimes a hard and brutal life. But she's always on the lookout for fun in a situation, be it the fact that her large family had to share a lavatory with the other tenants in the building, or at her ramshackle first wheelchair that allowed her to join in her siblings' games. I devoured this book, and I realised that one reason that I wouldn't have chosen it for myself was my own fear at being confined to a wheelchair. As a rock climber, that is always at the back of my mind. But there was nothing confined about Christine Marion Fraser. Her writing is remarkably uplifting, and through it I learnt more about my attitude to my own differing ability and the way that others react to it.
I had been in hospital 5 months and watched other patients come and go in such a steady succession that I was beginning to fear that freedom was something I would never know again. It was high summer. The trees waved thick green fronds in the breeze. The sky held the blue mists of heat in its entirety. I longed to smell the sweet air, to inhale the cool night winds heavy with the scent of new-mown grass. The summer smells filtered faintly in through the windows, but it wasn't enough for me. I wanted to embrace the sky, to roll on the earth, to feel the whip of the wind tugging my hair.
Christine went on to write no fewer than 4 highly successful series of romantic dramas, including the Rana, Kings and Noble sagas, and published 2 more volumes of memoirs. But for me, Blue Above the Chimneys is the gem that, but for a careless keystroke, might have remained hidden from me forever. It's available as Talking Book number 9871, and I must thank Nuala at the Talking Books Library for digging it out so that I could reread it over Christmas. So, do you have a hidden gem that you have discovered in the library? If so, please share it with us by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk.
sleeked cow and timorous beastie. Oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start away sae hasty wi' bickering brattle. I would be laith to run and chase thee wi' murdering pattle.
That's Hugh Ross reading an extract from Tuor Mhus, first published in 1786 in a volume called Poems Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect by Robert Burns, a book that's also known as the Kilmarnock edition.
I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal.
While Scotland's National Bard is celebrated globally on Burns Night on the 25th of January, Kilmarnock also look towards July 31st. Author Zoe Strachan, who's the patron of the Imprint Book Festival in East Ayrshire, explains why.
Well, it's a special day in the Scottish literary calendar, but one that isn't celebrated very much. It's the date in which the Kilmarnock edition was first published. So that's Robert Burns' Poems, Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect, one of really the key texts in the Scottish canon. And it was published here in Kilmarnock, very near the library that we're in just now, in John Wilson's print shop, on this day in 1786.
And this is an annual event?
It is. We've been doing it for a few years now. A few years ago, I had a post as a reader in residence with East Ayrshire Libraries, trying to develop different activities that would not just introduce people to new writers, but think about the existing literary heritage. So we've had all sorts of people come and speak about the Kilmarnock edition, speak about what Burns means to them. Tonight, obviously, Rona Brown, the head of Scottish literature at the moment at Glasgow University, and the poet William Letford. Last year, the poet Don Patterson was here. The year before, Ian Rankin. We've had various other people. So it's become a really nice annual event, and it's one that I look forward to very much. I think it attracts a different kind of audience. And Burns, it proves that Burns still has a place in people's hearts, in Ayrshire particularly. But of course, there's people who want to read and hear new work and hear about how he's inspired poets who are working today.
In attendance this year was poet William Letford.
What is it? The stonemason said, it's all in your head. Your eyes are like windies and your brain's gone nowhere. Build yourself a palace. The plumber told me not to complicate things. Everything is moving in one direction. We just carry it for a while, then let it go. A spark if you part it, said it's impossible to see, but you'll know when you've found it. It'll stop your head and throw you right out your boots. The labourer stood up. It's about strength, son. What can you carry? What can you leave behind? Rough cast Johnny said it's three parts sand and it's one part cement. It's all in the mix. The joiner stubbed out his fag. If a man's got the measure of his cell, what does it matter? I looked at the gaffer. Work hard, he said. But that was his answer for everything. Slate knife McCallum shouted for the roof. It's about perspective, son. Where are you standing? What are you looking at? Then the rain came. Heavy. Bouncing. Pockmarks appeared in Johnny's cement. Puddles were jumping around the sparky's feet. Half Brick McPherson pulled on his waterproofs. Listen to that, he said. This is it. I think this is it. I was asked to go and do a reading at a Burns supper, and it wasn't a traditional Burns supper. Rather than reading out Burns poems, they asked two Scottish poets to read their own work, and they had a piper and a folk singer. But they asked me to say the Selkirk Grace, and I didn't know what the Selkirk Grace was, so I thought, right, but I said aye. So I would just like, I would go back and I would look it up and I would get it down to pot. So then I went and looked up the Selkirk Grace, and it's just a wee short poem. Some's got meat and can eat, and some's need meat and want it, but we've got meat and we can eat, so the Lord God be thanked. And when I'd seen that poem written down, I recognised it. It's what my family would say around the kitchen table when I was younger. And it was amazing to know that that had entered my consciousness and been part of my history without me even knowing it was Robert Burns. That he's just his words have come up all through the centuries. You know, they're still getting said around kitchen tables without even being attributed to him, which I don't know if he'd be happy about, but they're still there.
We'll hear more from William in a moment, but also at the event, we travelled back in time to see what the reaction was like to poems chiefly in the Scottish dialect.
My name's Rona Brown and I work in the Scottish Literature Department at the University of Glasgow.
So what sort of reviews did Burns get when his book came out?
Reviews started coming out quite fast after the Kilmarnock edition appeared. He got real recognition for being a natural genius, but he also got a wee bit of trouble for being a bit controversial, for criticising the clergy, for being a bit of a libertine. So he got a lot of praise, but he also got a bit of criticism in early reviews.
We think Kickstarter and crowdsourcing is a new thing, but the Kilmarnock edition was essentially crowdsourced.
Yeah, it certainly was. One of the things that is really a kind of point of pride, I think, for Ayrshire at that time is that there's a huge list of subscribers to Burns's edition, which basically means everybody promised to buy the book when it came out, and essentially that's how the thing was financed. Same with the Edinburgh edition, actually.
Doubt no wiles, but thou may thieve. What then? Poor beastie, thou mon live. A daemon icker in a thrave. Small request. I'll get a blessing with the lave, and never miss it. Thy wee bit hoosie too in ruin. It's silly, was the winds were strewing, and naething now to bigger newin. Oh, foggage green. And bleak December's winds ensuing, both snell and keen.
A large exhibit in Kilmarnock Stick Institute, where the event was being held, is a full-size replica printing press, the same one that Burns' first edition would have been printed on by John Wilson. I was very lucky to meet the man responsible for building it, in which may be a bit of a surreal interview. Hi, Dad.
Hello.
So how did this full-size printing press come about?
It was a case of finding something when I was looking for something else. I came across this story about the printing press that never was, so I thought, well, why not give it a go and do what wasn't done then? It says here, "History has done badly by John Wilson. His name and generosity besmirched by misinterpretation." A successor to the Ayr Advertiser, Thomas M. Gemmell, had in the centenary year of 1859 the famous printing press converted into a commodious armchair. Mr. James C. W. Nicol, president of the Kilmarnock Number Nothing Club, is engaged with two gifted townsmen of his in building a replica of the Wilson Press, together with the original manuscripts, so this would feature a story of the Kilmarnock first edition in the proposed museum. But as most things of high drama, it's now or never.
That article was written in 1973, though. Why didn't it happen then?
I made inquiries, and several people who remembered this said the thing was that nobody knew what the press looked like. This was absolute rubbish, because printing presses of these days were all of the one kind. I got together a committee. There were some Burnsians, and one man in particular who was a carpenter. We got donations from various Burns clubs, but the real money came from the Heritage Lottery Fund. So we got the plans and set about building it, and it took about 2 years from start to finish.
The printing press, because it's a replica, is of course a very tactile exhibit.
Now, back to Burns himself and Dr. Rona Brown. Burns seems to have been a bit of a rebel against the establishment. Do you think... It's a funny word to use, but do you think he was a sort of punk of the day?
Some might say so. He certainly had long hair. He had it in a wee ponytail at the back. He was a bit rebellious in his dress sometimes, because when he went to Edinburgh and he was in all these drawing rooms with gentlemen dressed in the kind of traditional gentlemanly attire, he wore his farming boots and he kind of set himself up as different from everybody else. So certainly, if you think about a punk as somebody that kind of pushes against the establishment, I think certainly it was that.
Do you think, though, he was hiding his intelligence a wee bit, though?
In some ways, I think he was. In some ways, he kind of conformed to a marketable image of himself. So that idea of being untutored, being an autodidact poet, it's not true, because Burns had a lot of good reading. He did a lot of scholarly work when he was young. He knew a lot. But the kind of literary marketplace at that time, readership liked to believe that he was just a natural genius that had sprung up out of nothing, really. So he kind of helped that along.
So within the Scottish literary establishment, there was a sort of a case of who do you think you are?
Yeah. In fact, the first review of Burns's Kilmarnock edition says, "Who are you, Mr. Burns? Where were you educated? And who are you to come and entertain us?" essentially, it asks. And so you get this kind of mock reply from Burns saying, "Oh, I'm just a poor ploughboy and I try my best and just give me patronage if I need it." So he does conform to this idea of the heaven-taught ploughman, or as my colleague would have it, the rhinestone ploughboy.
As we heard earlier, also in attendance was William Letford, who has an MLit in Creative Writing from the University of Glasgow, was the recipient of a New Writers Award from the Scottish Book Trust, and also received an Edwin Morgan travel bursary, allowing him to spend 3 months in the mountains of northern Italy, helping to restore a medieval village. But he also worked as a roofer. Now, just as we were talking to Rona about Burns being the ploughman poet, I asked William if he was annoyed at being referred to as the roofer poet.
No, it doesn't annoy me, because I was a roofer and I am a poet. You know, and roofing was a part of my life for a long time. I worked for a family company, my uncle, my dad, so I'm proud of being a roofer. But I'm always on the lookout for anybody using it in a kind of derogatory way, you know, to kind of try and put you in your place. So I'm always on the lookout for that. But most of the time, people are genuine and it's said with affection, you know. Okay, so this is called "There's Hunters of Birds on the Roofs." "Here, how, choof, woof, wee robin, rit-tit, pigeon, breeste, lovey, dovey, ruffle your feathers, show me your plume. Look at that, Frank, not a look, not a nut, plod on then, mouldy, breeted, whoop, whoop, look at that, fingle, figgle, boogaloo, that's not even a crow, that's a dinosaur. There'll be teeth in that beak, that's for sure. Oh, biddy-eye, get behind the gable, she's fair, this social. What a life, Frank, what a life, feeding on scraps, hunting for crumbs. But listen to this, listen to this. We're no dodos. We can fly. Forget about the fields, Frank. Look at the sky."
There's very few sighted people in the world can read Braille. What's the rumour about you in Braille?
Okay, so I don't read off the page, so I just perform the poems without looking at the book. But when I first started performing, I would keep my hands in my pockets. And knew what I did is I hold a piece of paper or I hold a bottle of water just so my hands are like no in my pockets. But at the very beginning, I would keep my hands in my pockets, and I was doing a reading at a night called Discombobulate, which mixed literature with comedy. And the compere was a comedian. And he got up and he said, when I had got off the stage, "Now, most people think that William Letford reads from memory, but actually, it's pocket braille," which I thought was very, very funny.
The print version of your book's here, but do you think that it's meant to be read out loud?
I like to perform it out loud. I like to perform my poetry out loud. I think there's something in the voice, there's a texture in somebody's voice that you kind of get through reading it off the page yourself. So I think it's important. Poetry comes from an oral tradition as well. The reason that poetry rhymes is because when tribes are sitting around fires, they would make their lore and their stories and their advice rhyme, so it could be passed easier from generation to generation, you know.
Thanks once again to Zoe Strachan, to William Letford, Bert Kirkwood, Ross McGregor and Rona Brown. Chiefly in the Scottish dialect is an annual event held on the 31st of July, but there are many more events coming up, so have a look at eastayrshireleisure.com. The Burns extracts were read by Hugh Ross, and from the book Poems of Robert Burns, selected by Ian Rankin, which is available from RNIB Talking Books and RNIB Overdrive right now. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
Have you ever wondered what it takes to be a talking book narrator? I decided, having listened to so many talking books, that it was about time to find out how and why they do the wonderful job that they do. I'm delighted to be joined today in the studio by Kate Akello. Would you like to tell us how you became a talking books narrator?
So it's quite a personal thing for me, but I grew up with a blind mother and a blind uncle. Very, very capable people, very proud of them, but they were also avid readers when they could see. And so obviously when they lost their sight, it was very important to them that they still had the books that they enjoy reading. I was brought up always hearing talking books. When mum's ironing, when mum's in the bath, when mum's working out, she always has a talking book on. And to be honest, she can stay up until about 4 a.m. listening to them. They're addictive. And I realised as I got older how much an important thing it is for her to have that available to her, that really it would be silly if I didn't approach that as a skill that maybe I could help out with. The first time that my mum heard the audiobook, she found it online at 2 a.m. and I went into her bedroom and saw a very bleary-eyed, tired mother who decided that because it was my first audiobook, she had to stay up the entire night listening to it. And actually it was just such an emotional moment, really, because for some people it's, you know, it's just an audio book, but for me it's the only time that my mum gets to really see everything that I do as its whole. Obviously on stage there's always some visuals missing, but an audio book, it's just you, it's just the voice, and it's just the story. And so my mum experiencing that and being able to give that gift to her, and my uncle as well, was really, really special. And I'm so, so glad that I knocked on those doors and sent those emails.
One of the things I love about having professional actors reading the talking books is you are our eyes, and you're the person who puts the nuance into the voices and brings them alive and off the page.
When you do read a book, I must develop about 70 different accents in my head, and you always have voices for different characters. I remember in my audition for Here, I decided that I'd show them all the accents that I could do, so I chose a court scene of a book called Vernon Godlittle, where everybody was being questioned. And basically, I think we had an African in there, we had someone from Scotland, but actually, the more variation you can get, the more realistic it is to how you'd imagine it.
Do you have a favourite accent?
Well, I was born and bred in Newcastle, so I do kind of enjoy going back into the northeast accent when I can. I think it's always important that as an actor and a reader that you remember your roots and that you appreciate them and you nurture them as often as possible.
And what are you reading at the moment?
Amy Wilde, and it's by Helen Skelton, who actually, if people watched Blue Peter maybe a couple of years ago, she did a lot of the comic relief and the sports relief things. She did Thousands of Miles in the Amazon Forest. So this is actually set in the Amazon. A young girl from the northeast goes with her Aunt Marge, and we're about to find out all the adventures and the mischief that she gets up to. She's quite a naughty kid, which I...
Can you relate to that?
I can relate to that a little bit, but...
From a novice to an old hand...
I am very much an old hand.
I'm delighted to be joined by a voice that is not only familiar to me, but I hope to many of our listeners, Penelope Freeman.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So tell me, what have you been reading?
I have just actually finished The Inheritance by Jenny Pittman. It's a tale of doping and double dealing and sabotage and all kinds of other things. But yeah, it's been good fun.
I can't wait. That'll be one to brighten up the winter's evenings. So how did you start as a narrator for talking books?
Very, very simply, actually. I had a partially sighted grandmother. We were always trying to get her to listen to talking books. So I applied to the talking book studios. I wrote and I wrote and I bombarded and didn't get seen. And then finally I did, and sadly that coincided with my father becoming partially sighted. And my mum, who was an avid reader, got addicted to them too, so they would sit side by side and listen to talking books. It's just been historically in my family, and I like as many times as I can to come into the studios and do it. I do it professionally elsewhere.
And do you have a favourite genre that you like to read, or will you tackle anything?
I tend to get stories that are quite women-centric. I would secretly like to do more kids' books.
It reminds us of that, those wonderful days when your mum would read to you before you went to bed. Mm. And a good and sympathetic reading is one of the most comforting things I think you can have.
It's lovely for all kinds of reasons, because it does unscramble your brain. You just put your, you know, there's nothing worse than going to bed, putting your head on the pillow and thinking, oh, what have I got to do tomorrow? And, oh, I didn't kind of do that today or whatever. And you end up not going to sleep. I'm sure it's sleepless nights. People have them all the time because they are constantly having busy brains now. And it's a wonderful way of giving your brain a massage. That's the best way I can describe it.
So have there ever been books where you've read the first few chapters and just gone, I actually can't do this, and you've had to hand them back to the Talking Books Library and say, give me something else?
As a narrator, no. There was one I was very close to again, and I realised I was finding it quite disturbing. And it was only when I got a little bit further on in the preparation that I realised somebody had also been prepping the book, and they clearly had got to a point in the book where the prep, the pencil marks on the page had gone, and I realised that that was the point that they had probably given the book back. I thought, well, if RNIB had had difficulty already getting a narrator, and this clearly was one that was on the list to be recorded, I had to overcome that.
You were talking about the pencil marks in the margin.
Mm.
I've always wondered how the narrators keep the continuity. Do you keep notes at the front of the book?
Every reader does it differently, and every reader uses a different format. I read a book twice before I record it. The first is just to get a gist of the story, to get an idea of the pace of it and the genre and everything. And then the second, where I sit down and every single character I write out. And then the other thing I always do, the day of a recording, I go through the entire cast of characters. I try and remember as many as I can and put a voice to each one of them.
I always think that the narrators are discovering the plot at the same pace as I am, so not to bring in any vocal spoilers is quite an art, I should imagine.
Strangely enough, in a way it's not. You have to be in the moment. You have to make it now. When it gets exciting, your voice changes and you're going, oh, this is about to happen and that's about to happen. And you modulate accordingly, but you have to be in the moment to do it. Hopefully it stays fresh that way.
Two of the amazing team up in the Talking Books studio. We'll meet more of them over the coming weeks. And if you have a favourite narrator, why not drop me a line? The address, once again, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'll be back next Friday, when we'll be talking to Stephen Gross about his factual bestseller, The Examined Life. Thanks for listening, and remember to read on.